Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Nobody knows but Jesus. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. Glory, hallelujah.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Living Stone podcast, a podcast project from Greystone Baptist Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. I am Pastor Chrissy here with Bill Baxley, who is a congregant, good friend, and a thought partner when it comes to racism and trying to understand racism a little bit better. We are continuing our conversation of Drew Hart's book, Trouble I've Seen, understanding the ways that the church is impacted by and perpetuates racism. So we're nearing the end of the book, but just as we begin to think things are kind of winding down, Hart hits us with a really big, robust chapter, like chapter 8. And so we're going to work our way through chapter 8. We might get to chapter 9 today, but if not, we'll add on another episode. So we want to talk about renouncing every hierarchy, which is the title of chapter 8. So I want to give Bill a moment to talk to us a little bit about Hart's kind of thesis for this chapter, which moves us beyond understanding racism and white supremacy as just a black and white issue.
Well, thank you, Chrissy. This is my first podcast in my history. And so it's been very interesting in terms of the time that you spend in getting into a book and getting into understanding it. So it's been a privilege to work on this and draw a closer understanding of the issues that that Drew Hart is talking about. He continues in 8 and talks about what we've been having a conversation about. And that's really what, and it's about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And I suspect people will bristle at this terminology because we tend to equate white supremacy with the KKK.
Right.
But it is about privilege. It's about the white advantage. And it really wasn't until I went to the REI course for 2 days that I began to get a clear picture in my mind of what that really meant. But as we look back at history, this issue of white privilege, white advantage, white supremacy paints a different picture.
Mm-hmm.
There have been 400 years of positioning of white dominance due to stolen land, stolen labor, and it can make one feel justified, perhaps even feeling that this is what hard work will provide. But then when you ask the question, what happens under white advantage, white supremacy? Historically, you see the colonization and the conquest of the Americas. You see forcing native populations off their land and onto reservations. We see the oppression of early Chinese immigrant workers who helped build a railroad and exclude them from citizenship. We see sending Japanese immigrants into concentration camps during World War II. We see creating unjust and arbitrary immigration laws to keep Latin Americans from entering this country, as many European immigrants were allowed to do in the past. It's taking prejudiced postures toward Muslim and Middle Eastern people. Can it be that after 400 years, this white supremacy still exists? And yet the white church's discussion of this understanding is what? Well, I'm happy Greystone is beginning to have a dialogue because I don't think silence is any longer an option.
Yeah.
But don't get me wrong. It has taken the filming of a knee on the neck of a black man to get the white church engaged in a dialogue. We can't change history, but we can learn from it. So where are we today on white supremacy? We have a lot of stereotypes still. We have the Asian stereotype. Well-behaved, brainy, nerdy, bad at sports, hardworking, family-oriented, peaceful, make little trouble, Ivy League university, well-to-do, succeed by merit, petite, quiet, submissive women. Then we have the black stereotype. Ill-mannered, brainless, cool, athletic, lazy, bad parents, violent, break the law, high school dropout, poor, fat, loud, bossy women. And then we have the Hispanics, building the wall, But you know, when I looked at the stereotype of Hispanic, I began to think, did we build a wall for the Europeans coming in? Oh, that's right. We have a Statue of Liberty.
Right.
Say, you know, bring me your huddled masses yearning to be free. I wonder what those huddled masses are on the border of the U.S. and Mexico. I don't know. But unjust immigration laws, these stereotypes are substitutes for perhaps what is the basic issue that we need to address, and that is getting to know actual people, not the stereotype, but the people themselves. And this artificial polarization with whites in the middle helps to pit people of color against each other, leading to division where we should have unity. This is the point. This divide and conquer strategy fuels the modern racism that we're trying to address. The answer, an appropriate response to the complicated situation in society, Hart says, will not come from detached, objective analysis, cost-benefit calculations, efficiency quotients, and cultural arguments. The decisions that are made and courses of actions that are recommended should be commensurate with the life of Jesus, his actions and his teachings, his cross. It's the discipleship. The white church can lord its whiteness, or it can make sure that everyone, yellow, red, brown, and black and white, can be seated around the table of God as equals, where only Jesus is Lord over all.
Yeah, that was really powerful. And I think I love the way that you have pulled some of the best pieces of Hart's work there and laid it out for us. And you said something early on a moment ago. You said that we can't change our history, but we can learn from it. And one thing that jumped out to me when you said that was we have to learn the same history, right? Like,
yeah.
I think for a long time, you know, white supremacy is more than the KKK. It's more than white supremacists who march now in the streets kind of as an anti-black movement, kind of unashamedly. It's more than that. It's not just the undeniable racist individual who does a racist act. It's a culture of racism that permeates our systems and our own socializations. We talked about that some with the chapter on whiteness. And so for us to relearn our history from a different perspective means that we need to understand historical accounts that were not written by white people. And rather than negating them based on what we've learned from our, you know, our white educators and our white curriculum writers and our white school boards, we need to create space in our own imaginations that somebody else's experience might also be valid, even if it contradicts that which we always thought was true. So I think that's a really important point as we're thinking about our history. If we're going to learn from it, we have to be open to learning from all of it, not just one version of it. And the other thing that I thought was really profound in what you said, you know, when you were describing using the stereotypical terms, and Hart offers those to us in the chapter as well, when you're thinking about, you know, stereotypes of Black people, stereotypes of Asian Americans, stereotypes of Native Americans, you know, we don't ever think about what are the stereotypes of white Americans. And I wonder if that's because we as white people live within that culture, and so we understand how diverse it is, so we don't subject ourselves to those stereotypes. But if we were to layer over the same lens, or I wonder if we were even to just imagine that, you know, generations of history has some kind of formation in our own lives, we've got to begin to understand that our people have been colonizers for a long time. And we don't like to imagine ourselves as colonizers, because that's got a negative, you know, connotation about who we are. I'm not saying that we're all awful, mean people as white people. But I do think we need to recognize that piece about colonization. You know, all of the European countries, not all, but most of the Western European countries were colonizing countries a long, long, long time ago. So if we think about where our people came from, it's in our history, it's in our DNA, and it's been part of our family narratives in some way, shape, or form for a long, long time. And so as we begin to really do the hard work of understanding racism and re-educating ourselves, I think to just be able to at least acknowledge that a lot of us come from people who were colonizers, and there are some complicated pieces to that. And that, you know, to place ourselves within the story too, not just talk about the stereotypes of people who are not white, but also what are the stereotypes of white people? You know, and how are those true for us, and how are they not true for us? One thing that I respect a lot about Hart is, he calls out some things that are really hard for me as a white woman to process, but he's not afraid to call out himself. And he talks about his own sexist lens and how, you know, even understanding himself as a black male, he had some work to do in dismantling his own sexism, right? Because all these hierarchies that exist in our world go far beyond race. They extend to other areas where we kind of marginalize people and put them into categories. So he talks about being in school and having a professor who was quote unquote feminist, and how he was afraid to take her class because, you know, feminists hate men. And so, you know, God forbid we learn from them, you know, so he was afraid to take the class. But what he learned from a meek, kind, kind of soft-spoken woman who also had a PhD and had something to say was that when we read the Bible, and he uses the example of Luke 7, where the marginalized woman comes in and washes Jesus' feet with her hair, an incredibly inappropriate action from a very scandalous woman. What Jesus does is he centralizes her with his gaze. He looks upon her, and with his language, he calls out the men for all the things they did not do in the moment when she came in, and he centralizes and praises her activity, even though it was scandalous. And so Hart's challenge for us with regard to this particular hierarchy, sexism, which he's talking about, is allowing ourselves to be reframed, to gaze upon those who are marginalized without prejudging their actions as scandalous or inappropriate, but rather to gaze upon them with love and to use that as a reflective lens for our own selves. He used that as an opportunity to understand his sexism. And I continue, that'll be a life, I believe that'll be a lifelong journey for him, as it is for all of us who are dismantling an ism in our life. But I really appreciated the way that he framed that using the story from Luke 7.
The next section is talking about, do you see this woman? At first glance, I didn't pay much attention to that title. but as I read and began to read the Hart's explanation, I think it probably applies to a lot of situations and really begins to embody the word humility. Mm-hmm. Because when you can begin to see a person as a child of God rather than as a color or as a sex, then you begin to make a step toward embracing what Jesus came to talk about. That is the discipleship that I think Jesus is looking for the people that are going to follow him. In Luke 7, the Pharisee dinner, the sinful woman was noted by the Pharisee. Women in the society at that day were on the bottom rung.
Mm-hmm.
They, and even in the black community, black women
right,
are on the bottom
rung. There's a lot of sexism
rung.
There.
The church today in some denominations do not believe that women should preach. Is that dominance or not? Jesus called it what it was. The Pharisees saw the world through the vantage point of male patriarchy and female inferiority. So he saw people in two classes, clean or unclean. Sound familiar? Black versus white, rich versus poor, American versus immigrant. But Jesus asked, do you see this woman? What does the white church see today? And more important, if it does see, what's it doing about it? Well, this is my hope. The work of liberation for Jesus never skirted women. Throughout his life, Jesus sought to bear witness to God's love for all women on the margins. Yep, he died for us all.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, one of the things that Hart talks about and a lot of scholars talk about is the double marginalization that black women experience. Not only are they experiencing the oppression of being black in America in a racist society, but they are also experiencing the sexism of being female you know, in a patriarchal society. And often they're experiencing more intense sexism within the Black community itself. And as an outsider to that community, I don't feel super comfortable, you know, lifting that up as an extra layer. But I think to name the double marginalization that Black women experience as being both Black and female is significant. And Hart uses two women to kind of guide this section of his book. He talks about Renisha McBride, who was in an automobile accident and got out of her car and sought help at a neighbor's house. And she was met with a shotgun, and she was shot in the face, I believe. She did not survive that incident. And that's not the only time that an African-American person has been in a car accident and gone to knock on the door to get help, and they're met with gunfire, often lethal gunfire. And so I think it's important to note that Renisha McBride, and I mean, Hart's point is that she was a victim of that double marginalization of being Black and female. And she was in a neighborhood where, you know, Black women were not supposed to be. And he talks about kind of the scrutiny that often emerges when people are killed in situations like this. People want to go back and examine the character of the victim. And it's like a cycle of victim shaming that just really isn't fair. And it's a result of these systems of racism, of white supremacy, and of patriarchy, that we've got to find a problem with the victim to make sure, or to kind of build the case to defend the person who fired the shot. We want to understand why it happened, and the best way that we can make sense of it is by victim shaming, when really the situation was much more complex than that. Then he moves quickly from her to Oprah, which I think is fascinating, because a lot of times when we're in conversation, we're trying to understand whether or not we buy into this whole thing about patriarchy or racism, we use examples of people who have kind of broken free of the system, quote unquote. So we would say, well, like, what about Oprah? You know, she's one of the richest people in the world. So racism can't be that inhibiting in America. You know, Oprah found a way to make it. But then Hart tells a story about when she's shopping in Switzerland and she asks to see something and the clerk is like, well, you can't afford that, and wouldn't even get it out for her. And the irony is she could have bought the whole store probably. But because she is a woman, she's a Black female, this person made a judgment. Now, I don't know how anybody in the world doesn't know who Oprah is, first of all. So let's just lay that out where it is. Yeah. But she still finds herself at this intersection of double marginalization, being African-American and being a female. So I think that it's hard for us to hold all of this because it's really, really uncomfortable. But I don't know how you look at those two stories and still deny the hierarchies that are at work in their lives.
Yeah. I think back to the stereotypes, and, you know, as I was reading through those stereotypes, it was kind of didn't make me feel real good, because I'm sure in my life I've had some of those very thoughts. So Hart talks about lording over others, and he uses the example from Matthew with a mom and her two boys, and the mom wanted her boys to be on the right and the left side. And Jesus said, but because she wanted the best for her children, but Jesus said, nope, it's not mine to give. But we see Jesus on the cross with two others on crosses on either side of him. And he loved them. The disciples wanted to get rid of Roman oppression, but they also wanted the good life. But the scripture reveals a Messiah who embodies and fulfills the role of the suffering servant. My dad taught me a valuable lesson. I love a high school course so much that I was always first to answer. And finally, the teacher nicely told me to keep quiet. And I shared with my dad, and he said, it is better to be at the back of the room and ask to come to the front than it is to be at the front of the room and ask to go to the back. You know, I'm not sure the role of the servant fits the image we have for white America. But until we do, I think we're going to continue to have systemic racism. Will it take another 400 years, or can we begin the journey at Greystone of dismantling systemic racism where we can now?
Yeah. You know, I think the story you learned from your dad and the stories we find in the Bible are helpful images for us as white Christians when we began to think about what is our path of discipleship. About halfway into my first kind of serious delve into understanding racism and understanding white supremacy, I began to come to a conclusion that the path of discipleship for white Christians is one of descent instead of ascent. And for me, this is a reason why it's hard for us to worship with oppressed communities, if that's all our goal is. Mm. And we'll get to that in a minute. But I think liberation for an oppressed group of people is an upward trajectory. They're already at the bottom.
Right.
And so God's going to lift them up and bring them out and deliver them, just like God did in the Exodus. But white people are already free from economic stress, right? Mm-hmm. I think we have other paths of ascent, but I think as a whole, maybe generally speaking, our path is to shake off, to release ourselves from the binds of materialism and militarism and power that we so naturally are drawn to. So I'm not sure that God's work with us is lifting us up any higher. We're already pretty close to the top. Mm-hmm. And so I think our difficult journey of discipleship is one of descent. I think that is our spiritual path, generally speaking. That's a hard thing and probably a controversial thing to say. But the more I do work with race, the more I believe that to be true. And I find it to be true in my own life. I think, we can remember lots of different stories from the Bible. We can remember the rich ruler who comes to Jesus and says, which commandment is the most important? And Jesus says, well, all of them, and he says, well, I've done them all. And then Jesus says, okay, well now sell everything you have and give it away. And he's like, oh, not sure about that, So that's kind of where we are, I think, as self-righteous white Christians who think we have it all right because we've said the sinner's prayer and we're good with Jesus. Well, we're not good with our neighbors is the reality. So we need to start working on that. Hart talks about this myth of the white male figure. And just to say it quickly, I think his how he opens this section on page 160 is really profound. So I want to read some of that. He says, the body to which everyone else has had to align and conform has been the white, wealthy, Western male image. Assumed to be a balanced, objective, measured, and well-reasoned, this elite white male image has been sitting at the top of the social hierarchy, and it has organized life for all of us. White men themselves do not even live up to the myth, but the constructed image, nonetheless, has justified white men's superiority to other people groups and women for centuries. And I think this phrase is absolutely critical because I think this all within all of this is it exposes the issues of white supremacy, not only for women and people of color, but for men as well. Because the ultimate goal for all human beings is not to be balanced, objective, measured, well-reasoned, and wealthy. The goal for human beings is to be humble and kind and to be good neighbors, to show God's love in the world. And often money and power have nothing to do with those things. I think about, we talk about toxic masculinity and like the crisis of being male because of feminist movements and because of movements from people of color. White men are kind of in a crisis. And it's like, well, what does masculinity look like if I'm not guaranteed a good job that's going to support my family forever? Or how am I going to be a man if I can't do X, Y, and Z in relationship to all these other people in my life? And there's a lot of psychological breakdown happening for men right now because they've got to reckon with their own stuff related to white supremacy and patriarchy. And that is not easy either. So these systems of hierarchy that Hart is exposing are really causing some big problems. And I feel like, and I hope we're in a moment in history where we're going to start to break them down in a way that makes room for everybody to humbly come back to the table.
Yeah, those walls are there. And I come back to what I've said several times, I reckon, through these podcasts, and that is that the world doesn't need more walls. It needs more bridges.
Mm-hmm.
So how shall we come to the table? I think Jesus' hope is that all people come to the table. So how should we come to the table? That's the question. We've come through this book. We're getting near the end of the podcast series. And so the question is, how shall we come to the table? Hmm. Will we come as equals, where we truly listen to one another and not just dictate the actions that should follow? Will we listen? We can't listen unless we feel equality. As we come to the table, can we come in a way that we're no longer lording over others as the referee for social, political, and theological issues, but just come into the table as a child of Christ? Hmm. You see, Jesus identified with and sought to restore the Samaritans, poor people, vulnerable women, who compels us to renounce these hierarchies in our everyday Christian labors of love. He wanted to knock down those hierarchies you talked about. Mm-hmm. And you know, right under the noses of all those lording over others is a space created for the church. This is where I think the church has an opportunity to enter the picture and be a part of the solution rather than part of the problem. Mm-hmm. By following Jesus and taking actions to renounce the lording over others in all of its forms, whether it's race, sexual, gender, class, ethnic hierarchies, sexual orientation. So the question remains, how are we going to come to the table? Hmm.
I feel like that is such a powerful question. I kind of want to end there. I want to just let your question linger. How are we going to come to the table? Wonder how God might answer that within us.
With great hope, I hope.
Mm. Well, between now and the next episode, I hope you all will sit with that question. And maybe come back, the last chapter, Heart's got some prescriptions for us as to how we might remedy this, these issues, how we might begin to examine our lives in light of the hierarchies that we have been able to see. But between now and then, take some time. Take a week, take some time to ask yourself, how have you been coming to the table and how are you going to come to the table? See you next time.
Nobody knows the trouble I see.